And so what we're doing is we're processing large amounts of information. We're processing millions of news. We're trying to find the right questions to ask. We're trying to detect what could lead into a large-scale catastrophe. So we have some idea about what hotspots there are in the world, what geopolitical conflicts might arise. But sometimes Polymarket will not have the market. And so that's where I think my nonprofit has an edge on trying to identify the risks. And putting a thoughtful probability that is explained. In markets, you have the incentive to correct the probability, but also to not give the reasoning so that people bet against you and you can get more of an edge. My idea, business model I was thinking about was, I would love to for these people to pay my forecasting team to run continuously.
Yeah.
To just tell them, know when you should go to the banker.
Yeah.
If you're paying for a banker, I'd love to get that service. I'd love to give that service.
In 2011, IAPA, an arm of the US government, found that there was a select group of people that were so good at predicting the future that they even outperformed intelligence analysts with access to classified information. These are the super forecasters, a select group of a few hundred individuals with consistently higher accuracy about predicting the future than even subject matter experts. And this is true across a wide variety of domains. My guest today is Nuno Sempere, a legendary forecaster whose track record puts him at the top of even greatest forecasters in the world. Among his many credentials, he's a founding member of Samitveti, a forecasting group which has been described by Scott Alexander as some of the best forecasters in the world. They won the CSET Fortell forecasting competition by an absolutely obscene margin, around twice as good as the next best team in terms of their relative Brea scores. The point of forecasting tournaments is to figure out who you can trust. The science has spoken, and the answer is these guys. Nuno works as an independent consultant, and he's recently founded a nonprofit called Sentinel, an early warning system for global risks like pandemics, wars, and financial turmoil. Nuno, welcome.
Thanks, Adam.
So I'd like to start just by giving an audience that perhaps is unfamiliar with the world of forecasting or formal forecasting, modern forecasting, a bit of a scaffolding to help them understand how it might differ from like a futurist that they might see at a conference, or somebody that's kind of hired to just sort of think about the future. Can you walk us through how your process differs?
So overall, I'd say that forecasting is a specific tradition of knowledge that was started by Phil Tetlock, who created the super forecasting team that you were talking about. And it focuses on putting probabilities, specific numbers, on predictions about the world, and then checking them later, which allows you to check if you were wrong, if you were right, by how much, in a way that gives you a feedback loop that is different from the one that you might see in academia or in a futurism conference. Even then, experts and academics are inputs into the numbers that we put and the probabilities we arrive at. It's just that the forecasters aggregate that uncertainty in a way that has a really good feedback loop.
Sure. And, just to really kind of drill down here, I think a lot of people, even in positions of, authority with large, I'm thinking of institutions here, tend to think of forecasts as something like, will an event happen?
Right.
Yes or no? Mm-hmm. It's a binary outcome. I said yes, and I was right. Or I said no, and I was wrong. Or perhaps there's a date associated with it. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is quite a bit more sophisticated. You'll tend to think of things in terms of percentage terms.
Right.
Across, let's say 100 different forecasts that you make, some might be 99% near certainty. Mm-hmm. Some might be, 10%, 1 in 10 chance of happening. And with the idea being ultimately that across all of these different forecasts and all these different events, when you analyze in retrospect, the ones that you said would happen 10% of the time should happen roughly 10% of the time, right? And then you can assess who's the best at this by plotting a regression and coming up with what your error is.
Right. Here's a nice example.
Yeah.
I was at the focusing conference and they gave me this coin. So if I throw the coin and I see it, it's either heads or tails. So then I look at it and then I see whether it's heads or tails. So I assign 100% to the correct outcome.
Yeah.
But then you don't know which heads or tails it is.
Mm-hmm.
So you assign 50%.
Right.
So this is the sort of the simplest, most cookie cutter example of a probability.
Yes.
If you throw it twice, then you'd have a 25% of two heads and two tails.
Sure.
And so on.
Yeah.
And so you want to have that calibration.
Mm-hmm.
But then for events that are much more complex than just coins and don't necessarily have that need of a structure.
Right.
Like wars, presidential elections, many other things.
Sure. So why don't you kind of walk through from the very simple example of the coin, where the probabilities are essentially can be like almost deterministic, through to something that's like slightly more complex, and then through to like let's think about something that's like a reasonably common event type. Mm-hmm. You're talking about like you mentioned the example of a presidential election,
right?
You know, let's think about that, and then maybe we can talk a little bit after that of like something that's like perhaps never happened before, like how you might consider an event. Such an event.
So from a coin, you can go to something like a die.
Right.
From a die, you can go to something like a poker game where you don't only have the probability of the cards, you also have to think about how people are bluffing or not. Mm-hmm. But even then, you have a strong probability component. From a poker game, you might go to a presidential election in a system which has two parties.
Right.
A good probability to start there is still 50%.
Right.
In part because if any of the two parties are too far away from 50%, they have more of a reason to compromise on their policies.
Right.
So that's a good starting point. And you can you can do polling, you can do statistics, you can ask people what they think other people will vote.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at people's popularity rankings and see whether incumbents have an advantage or not. So this would be an election in a place like the US.
Right. Nate Silver became quite famous doing this sort of thing, like disaggregating high level popularity polling across the country,
sure.
Looking at individual states,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is obviously the level at which presidents are elected.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing a few more things as well, right? Looking at quite a sophisticated model that looked at previous elections.
Yeah, he looked at previous elections. He added some factor for economics. He was modeling the different demographic groups in some details because you have imperfect polling, but you can adjust because you know what share of the population is the youth.
Right, some people aren't mm-hmm. on the phones or what have you.
Right.
So the poll that's published isn't mm-hmm. necessarily representative, but you can do some work to help kind of compensate.
Eventually that method, the imperfections and the limitations of that method became more apparent because reaching people, a representative sample of the population turns out to be fairly hard. Even then, the case of the U.S. is that you have two political parties, or you have had in the part. So in the case of the U.S., you have had two political parties. You can move on to something like Germany that has complex coalitions. And so then you not only have to predict the share of the population that will vote to different parties, but then also the possible coalitions. This still has some neat structure and some neat historical frequencies that you can draw on. You can then move to something more subjective, like would Trump declare the Insurrection Act? And you can look at, it was invoked reasonably frequently after World War II to the tune of 10 times in 80 years, so it's not that unlikely. And then you have some riots in LA, and so you can update from that. You can then go from there to, what's the probability of a really big solar storm, where you have seen past solar storms. You can kind of try to fit a distribution to a really big solar storm, or you have seen asteroids hit the Earth, and they're rare, but we have a historical track record of how large big asteroids are. And then you can move to even more speculative things, like will China invade Taiwan? will the U.S. lose its...
somewhat unprecedented type of activity, somewhat unprecedented, you know, you and I both done a lot of work on AI forecasting, for example, where it's like it's very difficult to find like what this base rate of a particular thing might be.
For AI, it's there is still some structure in past technological progress. So you can look at a wide range of technologies, from say the Bessemer process to the evolution of trains,
rail networks,
to the evolution of railways, to radio, semiconductors, etc.
Like we're thinking about like adoption curves.
Yeah, so you can look at adoption curves.
What the production rate is like in these sorts of circumstances.
And you can for example ask yourself, how many of these in the past have had a sharp jump, and how big has the jump been? And of course, that's not going to extrapolate perfectly to AI. And technological progress has the neat feature that indeed it brings you new things you haven't seen before. But maybe that's a lens that you can can look at.
Sure. So one of the things I've noticed, and you know, obviously I'm far less experienced than you in this field, but I've been involved in a number of exercises, including with Philtech Lock, is that there seems to be, roughly speaking, three different kinds of approaches that are taken, and I'd be interested in whether you feel this is true. One is a sort of a hyper-quantitative approach. These kinds of the super forecasts that I've talked to that are in this kind of way are essentially performing a role similar to what you might see in a quant trading firm. Mm-hmm. Many of them are, in fact, working for a quant trading firm, either because they were already or because they've been recruited by Jane Street or similar. And what I see them doing is essentially very large numbers of forecasts across like a wide range of like diversified fields, but where there's like relatively mechanistic type interactions going on. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, you know, there's various websites where this can be done, in some cases for play money, in some cases for money. And they're really looking at like relatively small edges over a market and then winning in the aggregate. On the other side, I tend to think of the archetype almost as like a European aristocrat with like a very broad world knowledge and perhaps a less sophisticated mathematics ability, but really an ability to kind of work through for a particular forecast what the kind of world states might be like in those in order to bring about that event.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say predicting the chance of a 20% year-on-year growth in world GDP by 2050 is a sort of like AI-related kind of question. And then kind of thinking back through, okay, well, you're probably going to need some kind of quite sharp discontinuity in terms of something like energy production. And then we can, and for example, but some reason that's sort of held back, maybe with a pandemic, and then you kind of can go through the base rate kind of process that we talked about there, multiply these probabilities together across like a wide range of these potential worlds that lead to this particular outcome. And then, the probability is kind of like the weighted sum of these events.
And there's a third approach.
And then there's a third approach, which is like what I call, maybe there's a fourth, but I think of like meta forecasting ultimately, where, and I think Ezra Kaga, who works with Ted Locke, is perhaps the like, done a lot of work in this space. Every time Scott Alexander runs a forecasting tournament, he's like there every year in the top five. And as I understand it, his approach is largely to look at other people's forecasts. Right? So like he looks at, you know, what's Nuno saying, what's the prediction markets on the same. We can talk a little bit about prediction markets, which is kind of like another case of this, where people are buying and selling and trading on some conditional on some future event, and then the forecast that the market is presenting is the kind of aggregate of these. And Ezra sort of looks across as many different of these forecasts as he can and has quite a sophisticated model that depends on the accuracy of these different places. And so it's kind of like a wisdom of the crowds type approach, but in a really kind of rigorous fashion. Mm-hmm. But is there like another kind of methodology that you're thinking of? Or is that broadly kind of aligned with your view as well?
So I thought about the spectrum between the first two. You do have a spectrum ranging from how much data do you have.
Sure.
If you have a lot of data, you can throw some very powerful statistical machinery, and you can do randomized trials across a large population. If Norway has some really good surveys, if you have even more data than that, you're maybe YouTube that has data from what people click on, then you can train machine learning models to make recommendations. If you have less data than that, you can still look at what the historical frequency of something is, and then make some adjustments based on judgment calls about how our different things are. So that's the spectrum that I was thinking about. But then it does make sense to have a meta approach of having different platforms that use different methods to incentivize probabilities, having some taste about when to apply more powerful methods that may overfit if you only have very little data. That makes sense.
Would Summit Sveti, the group, kind of be an early example of this almost? Like, you're obviously a group of you. You're discussing different ideas. You're coming up independently with your own forecasts, debating them. You kind of ultimately come with a meta forecast.
Right, yeah, for sure. The group is much stronger than the individuals alone, even though the individuals are fairly strong. But we will differ in terms of, say, sympathies towards the Trump administration or...
Sorry, can you just unpack what you mean by that?
Yes, so if you're making a political a focus about a political event, it's very useful to have somebody who actively dislikes the Trump administration and is able to point out the flaws earlier,
right? But
versus somebody who is sympathetic or amused or ideologically closer to the Trump administration,
right,
who takes the other side. You can also have somebody who just lives in a different country and
just
cares less.
I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of just like one comparative advantage that I've had in my forecasting, perhaps, is just like a extreme distance and living in New Zealand from the sort of like day-to-day goings on and what some particular expert that's kind of high status is maybe like speculating about the future of some particular technology. Oh, you know, in 3 months it's going to be this, and you know, and maybe he's right, but you know, like, you're, this is kind of almost back to the original insight of the Tetlock's 2011 study, is that more often than not they're not right, or at least you can outperform their predictions by taking a kind of a broader based approach. So I think hopefully that gives people a bit of a sense of the state of the art. You know, we could probably sit here and talk about it all day, but I'm really keen to turn to your nonprofit, Sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a fascinating example of like what, like, you're publishing this risk forecast, these risk forecasts for like a summary for decision makers every week. There's more in-depth work. A lot of this is freely available online. You can just Google Sentinel Substack. That'll get you there. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about it?
So there are many topics that you can focus on. The niche that we've chosen are large catastrophes that could kill over a million people. In part because we think that the importance profile of this is... because we think that focusing on them is valuable, in part because other people are covering other parts of the space. Right. And so what we're doing is we're processing large amounts of information. We're processing millions of news. We're trying to find the right questions to ask. We're trying to detect what could lead into a large-scale catastrophe. So we have some idea about what hotspots there are in the world, what geopolitical conflicts might arise. We also have a level of uncertainty and willingness to be surprised, but we also expect that some of the worst catastrophes are things that we may not see coming long beforehand. Because in part because if we If we could, it would have been easy to prepare.
Right.
And then...
It's like Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns.
Yeah. You can do something that, you know, Nassim Taleb is not going to like, which is to say, okay, what's the frequency of flax runs that you have seen over the last, you know, 20 to like 100
years?
For a
certain definition of black swan, like at the state level, for example.
I mean, Nassim Taleb is not going to... My inner Nassim Taleb is screaming because he's saying, oh, you can't really model outside. You can really model stuff outside the distribution, but you kind of can. You can think of like how often our society has been greatly surprised by events.
Right. But would these be essentially, do you think that these, it's quite interesting. do you think that these are like, uncorrelated? Like what would a state, let's say, do with this information? Like, is it purely academic? Just thinking of the black swan type thing, like we haven't had a black swan in 4 years, so like we need to be kind of preparing or what?
Yeah, so let me give you a historical example of what you could do with this information.
Mm-hmm.
Before nuclear weapons arose,
mm-hmm.
It's really difficult to think that they might exist. Only a few physicists were able to conceptualize them.
Right.
And then even the same physicists that actually created the weapons were saying that they might be impossible a few years before.
Right.
Similarly with, say, radar, a bunch of improvements in semiconductors, flight, that kind of thing. So for me, the takeaway is that your threat models should contain some weight on the specific threats that you might be worried about, say AI, bio, great power conflict, and so on.
Right.
But they should also have a chunk on response to things that we can't currently think about. And so, for example, if the U.S. is... The U.S. recently renamed its Center for AI Safety within the government to the Center for AI Security. And as part of that, they said, okay, we're going to look at... demonstrable threats. So we're going to look at cybersecurity, bio, and a couple others, right?
Mm. This is mainly in like response to the kind of idea of China kind of stealing tech and so on.
Yeah. So this. Yes. Yeah, so you yeah, can
or making use mm-hmm. of their own tech. For like drone warfare and so on. We can get on to this mm-hmm. a little bit later, but just
kind of to wrap up that point. So you can answer. So you can create a response, or you can be worried about a specific threats. But if you look at the number of black swans that we've seen over the last 100 years, there have been a fair number. So yeah, so that influences our approach, and we want to make forecasts on large scale risks sooner.
Sure. So this idea of black swans. So let's say we look at this frequency, and one could argue it's almost constant throughout the 20th century.
Yeah, maybe.
Or every few years, there's some like completely game-changing technology or event. Would the primary takeaway for a state ultimately be something like maintain flexibility and slack in order to be able to have mm-hmm. capacity to respond quickly to something that's, you know, unexpected?
Yep.
Right. Okay. What, like, nothing much else that one can do in that space? Or do you think there's...
One can look at common points of failure.
And I could
say food supply. How does your food supply look like?
Right, okay.
And Europe is massively subsidizing. It's agriculture sector.
Sure.
Which most years is pretty wasteful.
Right.
But what it does get it is, okay, non-dependence.
Some resilience
on Ukraine, which... used to produce a lot of weed, right?
Sure, okay. Yeah. Cool. So, I mean, one of the things that I'm like, so you've got the Sentinel published weekly mm-hmm. with more in-depth work as well published alongside, but there's like a risk summary, which is roughly like it's an executive summary almost, really. It's like a page or two just breaking down, this event has occurred. And then here is the our assessed likelihood of, you know, potential follow-up events. So it might be the trade tariffs have come in place, and then here is kind of our expectations for how that might go, or the risk of global recession, you know, those kinds of like mm-hmm. you know, highlights. And this is like done across global health, depending on the you mm-hmm. know, what's been happening. There's a sort of an update there in terms of, you know, from economics, from global conflict, from, mm-hmm. you know, these key risk events.
Yeah. So more specifically, we're looking at risks and things that could become large scale risks.
Yes, sure.
So the niche that we have is, if something becomes a really large catastrophe in the like couple days to couple months range, here's what that could be.
Right. And you're doing some quite interesting things, as I understand it, with like data scraping of the news. Yes. In order to help populate, like, and give you, mm-hmm. it's not just a few guys in a room that happen to be really great at forecasting. Yeah. You've kind of like, you're really setting the scene, and you've got some models to make sure you're not missing mm-hmm. Important events that just don't happen to be covered like by the New York Times or something, yeah. your standard feed.
Yeah, so we are processing millions of news. I think our setup is quite promising. Hmm. I was talking with some hedge fund guys that were doing next level stuff that they were willing to somewhat share with me at the Manifest conference.
Right.
So we'll be improving that.
Yeah.
But it's already quite potent. And in particular, one fun thing that happened to me recently is I have this general level scrapers on the internet. And they recently found themselves. So we put out this newsletter. So my scrappers went through the internet and said, oh, you might like it. This research is like highlighting.
Sure. And it's risks, your own thing.
And it's my own thing.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, it's good. Like, it's clear, like, you know, some degree of the increasing salience of your
yeah,
your
so work. It's a function of the yeah. increasing salience of the thing that we're doing, but then
may
also
it long continue. May it long continue. Sorry, may go continue, on.
Yeah. But also that our general purpose passes are finding what we want them to find.
Sure. Yeah, perfect. So, I mean, you know, like I said, you know, if there's one takeaway, go and look this up. But yeah. It seems to me that, you know, that this is just like you've got some of a team of the world's best forecasters, and we've established now what like that means. Mm-hmm. Publishing for free this information, it's in a quick executive summary. I mean, it seems to me that like any institution that has kind of global reach or importance or mm-hmm. state level institution, whether it's a civil defense or, you know, the president of prime minister's office, you know, somebody should be like having like subscribing to this and just like, you know, spending 5 minutes of like on a Monday or whenever it is, just reading through. Okay. Yep. No, that's interesting. A 10% chance. Okay. Well, I should probably start, mm-hmm. you know, I'll direct somebody to just go have a little look into that and see what our exposure might be. Mm-hmm. Or conversely, you know, there's a social media contagion is a thing, and mm-hmm. panic spreads and so on. And, you know, everybody's suddenly talking about something. You see this time and again. The tendency perhaps would be otherwise if inordinate amount of resource potentially spent on something that is for a few days considered to be almost certain, but you talk to people that with, you know, the sort of more of the rigorous approach or read this newsletter, and maybe you only see it's like a 20% chance or something. Mm-hmm. So you can just calibrate like how much attention should be paid to these different things, as well as, you know, black swans aren't black swans for everybody, right? Like, you know, they're very common in New Zealand. I don't know if you know the original story, but, you know, it's like for Europeans, it's like, well, swans are white until they're not. But, you know, there's information asymmetries. Mm-hmm. Chances are, with all the work and the infrastructure that you're putting in and continuing to prove it, there's a good chance that there'll be times where you're aware of something, like a category of threat that might just otherwise completely pass by, mm-hmm. You know, and never be considered at all, unless...
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It can be quite anxiety-inducing to have a sense of, you know, all the bad things that are going on.
Sure. Yeah, I can imagine. So what kind of do you see, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know from your subscriber list, which might just be an email address but, you know, are you seeing sort of an uptake in institutional kind of use of this fashion, or mm-hmm. is it mostly kind of nerds like myself.
So one fun thing I can do is I can look at the domain name of an email.
Right.
And so if it's a Gmail, right. Then...
Could be anybody.
Could be anybody, but then if it has a domain, then I can look a bit more into that.
Sure.
So we have some nice people listening to it.
Right.
But we have some adoption across the halls of power, but not that much.
Right, right. You know, we were talking about this before. So you know, maybe this will improve it on the margins. An interesting kind of related idea to this is that access to power doesn't necessarily corrupt, mm-hmm. but can. You know, we could see a situation where Nunez like sells out because he's really mm-hmm. like passionate about some particular thing, and that allows him to affect his judgment a little bit, yeah. in terms of a particular thing, and you know, like this forecast goes on in this way, and then with the expectation in your mind that might affect yeah. a decision maker in a way that you want. And you know, I think this is like reasonably common trend for intellectuals mm-hmm. In some respects after access to power. You know, it's very difficult to maintain independence, like true mm-hmm. independence, in the way that when you're just some guy without like thinking consequentially about, you know, if I say this, then why will happen or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just dispassionate, you're putting it out there into the internet. But I suppose the nice thing about this particular case and is just like the degree of rigor mm-hmm. that is brought through, you know, the forecasting process that we've talked about mm-hmm. is that you can judge like yeah. in 3 years' time or a year's time, like is Nunez still putting out good forecasts? Is this group still actually like, you know, really accurate? Or is this, you know, this other group of like, you know, complete nobodies that have been publishing yeah. recently, actually let's switch to them? You know, which there's like, so there's like a robustness to it that I don't think, you know, you don't normally expect from mm-hmm. kind of the introduction of power, which I think is lovely.
Yeah, maybe my expiry date is just a couple of years, but then before then, hopefully I'll give some signal.
So beyond sort of like the immediate, like, okay, clearly people involved in like national civil defense, like just put it on there. Do you see that there being kind of like more applications for this project in particular? Or like the integration of the kind of forecasting that we're talking about into institutional decision making more generally. You know, we've talked specifically about this kind of like high level catastrophic risk kind of mm-hmm. kind of forecast. But you know, like I'm just curious to see like where you see the whole field going as it becomes like more salient and more integrated with institutions.
Yeah, good question. I think. Many of the institutions in the space don't really have a business model. A bunch of the platforms can try to charge fees on trade. So if you're a prediction market and you're incentivizing people's beliefs through financial gain, you can try to get some fees, but that's tricky because people can move to a different platform. You can try to get donations, Yeah, but that's in some sense maybe a different problem than forecasting, and so building institutions there is somewhat tricky. You can try to be a hedge fund that makes money but doesn't make their judgments public. So to some extent this is something to figure out. So this is on the where will the field? How is the field trying to?
Those internal to the field, which directions they're going.
Yeah, yeah. How are they trying to? Well, they're trying to produce value, but then also to capture a fraction of it, and that loop is quite interesting. Mm. And then to the other part, maybe to the other implicit half of the question would be like who gets that value, and you can have a range from individuals to large institutions.
Right.
So if I say that the chance of Russia using a tactical nuke has risen a bit, then if you're nearby, or if you're in the region, maybe you want to move to the countryside for a bit, that'd be unattainable but very small impact. You can influence the small institutions. Maybe you have a company that is geopolitically exposed, that's China US trade. You can think of large insurance companies that might also want to have models of exposure, and we're trying to do some work there. And then you know, there's a lot you can think of, larger and larger companies and then states. So but to some extent, figuring out how to integrate the forecast with existing institutions, and how to build institutions that can integrate themselves with people making decisions, is a different flavor of a problem than just making the forecasts.
Sure. So you, in most cases, I think at the moment, either the information is public in the sense of it's published by yourselves, or you can go on to a market like Polymarket and just like there'll be some question there, a bunch of people are trading, you can kind of get a general sense of, okay, this is like the likelihood of you know, a particular event happening. And I think like the recent US presidential election was like quite a good example of that, where you know, the Polymarket had like a significantly higher win percentage for Trump than the kind of like the general punditry.
In part, quite interesting, because a large trader made a very high volume conviction trade, which is quite interesting, because it brings this subjective factor that we were talking about. So it's not just the coin; it's you know, the conviction and the willingness of somebody to put their money behind that coin.
Yes. And in that case, as I understand, they'd done like an enormous amount of like quite innovative work with the idea that many of the polls contained a systematic bias, because people were unwilling to say kind of to a stranger that they were going to vote Trump.
Yeah.
And then quite a clever kind of approach was to do some selective polling in key states and ask people what they thought their neighbors were going to. So I suppose there's a few things here. One is, you know, it's interesting that you've got this like mechanism now that these markets are sufficiently like sizable and mature to incentivize that kind of not only thinking and investment into like the getting an edge in that sense, but also it's probably like difficult to overstate how valuable this is to like the general public, right? Like whether it's companies, you know, previously you've only got like access to, you know, whatever the kind of Gallup poll is saying, and then suddenly you've got in, you know, something which is objectively and verifiably more accurate, and you've got like these various incentives for people to kind of spend quite a bit of money, but only in the cases that they feel that there's a significant mispricing. Right. Because you've got like the situation where like most questions are probably pretty well covered by like general consensus or what have you. You know, like as a society or as an institution, whether it's a, you know, a business or a government, doesn't want to be putting a whole heap of resources into asking like detailed questions and getting some really like smart people on every single question, when, you know, like instead we've got this kind of emerging incentive structure that is like really only kind of in, you know, creating those kinds of incentives to do that really innovative stuff when, you know, the market is, or they feel that the market is wrong.
Yeah.
And they get paid out if they win. If they don't, then they, you know, then it's really only them losing.
Yeah.
Rather than this, like the public.
Yeah. And so so I'm generally a fan of these platforms. I think that the property that the people who are very often get a larger bankroll is really interesting. And at the same time, they do have limitations. Maybe the most salient to me is that sometimes they don't have the question. So if you have a liquid market with the possibility of winning a million if you do the best research, Polymarket is going to be really good at that.
Yeah.
But sometimes Polymarket will not have the market. And so that's where I think my nonprofit has an edge on trying to identify the risks.
Sure.
And putting a thoughtful probability that is explained. Because in markets, you sometimes, you have the incentive to correct the probability, but also to not give the reasoning so that people bet against you and you can get more of an edge. Whereas we just do make the reasoning public, which is something we could also improve, though.
But there's other kind of failures of markets, these markets as well, right? Like they're sort of systematic, have like a systematic problem with like when the probabilities get either very, very low or very, very high, especially relative to, because you end up with like, let's say like some people just have like some mad conviction that like aliens are going to land, you know, for example, or that like, you know, this particular thing. And so in actuality, but it should be 99%, not 98%. But the incentive for like a market participant to like close that gap between like, so if they're buying at 98%, they only stand to, you know, make a 0.2% return on that. In which case, like it's depending on how long it takes for the market to close, it might be an event that's happening in 6 months' time. They're better off just buying bonds, like, you know, from the government or something. And I guess sort of related to this is the fact that they really struggle with like longer time horizons too, right? For similar reasons.
Yeah, for sure.
So extreme events, long time horizons, you know, which is kind of exactly the niche.
Well, I mean, we don't have that long horizons, on something like the 2 month scale, it's only considered long term by hedge funds. Like we're making a long term play, and it's 2 months.
Sure, but I guess also like very like, and the other thing would be just very short time horizons as well, right? Like if something's happened and you're trying to like, you can make an assessment quite quickly about such and such, whether something, you know, like some follow-up event will happen this week, which might be critical for a decision maker. But a market, by the time, you know, it's being created, people become aware of it, are trading in it, and, you know, the price reaches some equilibrium, that might take, you know, weeks.
Yeah, possibly.
All right. So to turn now, you besides your nonprofit, which you know people should donate to, you also do some consulting work as well. People can hire you for I think it's like currently $150 an hour, but maybe that's like going to rise rapidly.
Yeah, that has been rising.
Yeah.
At the same time, the government of New Zealand is very welcome to reach out.
Yeah.
It's geopolitically in a good position to survive some of the more out there catastrophes. It is closer to China, but at the same time,
we're very far away. Actually, we're not closer to China. Yeah,
interesting.
It's basically like equidistant from here to the US. Oh. The Pacific is absolutely enormous, but it is our largest trading partner. We buy a lot of our milk and dairy products. Sorry. Interrupt, but
No, it's not a good position to weather wars.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some of the long tail events I'm worried about. Peter Thiel famously has a couple bunkers there, right? Bunch of billionaires have.
Sam Altman, I believe. Yeah.
My idea, you know, one business model I was thinking about was, I would love to for these people to pay my forecasting team to run continuously.
Yeah.
To just tell them when you should go to the banker.
Yeah.
If you're paying for a banker, I'd love to get that service. I'd love to give that service. But
But you've been doing kind of small scale stuff for people as well, just like kind of advice about what they should do and
So I think this is good for the market discipline. Just, am I providing value to people?
Right.
At the same time, what I really want to be doing is building this institution up.
Sentinel.
Yeah, I want to be building Sentinel up. Right. I think it's a good niche. I think we have some good core forecasting. Mm-hmm. And then I'm juggling the funding and the distribution. So the listeners and readers, the people at institutions that could use it. And the forecasters and the people that we can employ. So,
Okay. So to sort of change tack a little here, what's one thing you disagree with, like, a current broad public consensus on? Like, what's like a really salient one where you think everybody else is wrong?
But no, right? Like, if there is a strong public consensus, yeah, I am going to give something. Like, it'd be hard for me to say to give less than 10% of it.
Sure.
That said, I tend to think that people's pictures of the future are sometimes too specific.
Okay. Yep.
So there was this recent 2027 exercise, which I thought was great, right, but because it was conditioning on a lot of stuff, I think the probability of getting that particular scenario without any crucial considerations that don't arise is lower than some of the people in my cluster, which isn't necessarily the greater intellectual sphere.
I think this idea of people being like way too like crystallized about the future is like extraordinarily common, both in like general society. There's some degree of probabilistic thinking that's like present in almost everybody of like, oh, you know, I think this is going to happen, but I'm not entirely sure. I think, you know, like, so there's kind of some, they understand that there's some range of possible outcomes. But I think that maybe it's particularly in this day and age where given like just how much change we're seeing, that really people should be a lot more like fuzzy, yeah, about like the exact shape of what that ends, yeah, up looking like, rather than kind of specifically pointing to like this and this. And, you know, it's every time, this is a very classic like futurist conference sort of thing, as an example, which people love, you know, because it's like often these people are quite charismatic, and paint like a really vivid picture of the future. But it's always like, oh, you know, we're going to see like autonomous vehicles in every city, and, you know, you're going to have, people won't be able to drive, you know, normally because they all have, you know, and you can kind of construct the scenario, mm-hmm, which is like 8 or 9 different layers of, you know, what's going to happen with the street lights and regulation and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's probably true that like pieces of this puzzle are quite likely,
mm-hmm,
but that like the combined probability of all of them together is, for like, sure, actually extraordinarily low.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just an interesting one.
So, yeah, but in some sense, I do have sympathy for that.
Because, oh, sure.
Painting and conceptualizing different futures it's still fairly valuable.
Yes.
It will fit into my models.
Yeah.
But if I have to think about the actual uncertainty that there is, that's to some extent a different question, right?
Right, right. All right. I was keen to kind of talk about China. we raised it earlier, I think, in the context of, mm-hmm, Taiwan. You know, the forecasting conference that we've just been, mm-hmm, at, you know, one of the perhaps primary topics of discussion, there seems to be quite a consensus here that maybe that's one answer to the question I asked earlier, is like, people seem to, I think people here and over the last 3 days seem to be much more bullish on, you know, China's kind of near to medium term prospects,
mm-hmm,
than maybe the world as a whole, which I think is maybe still caught up a little bit in, you know, what was true perhaps 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Friends of mine kind of are still have a model of like Chinese manufacturing as being like extraordinarily labor intensive, and that's, mm-hmm, why, you know, that's the source of their competitive advantage, whereas, you know, like, you know, in fact, you're talking about a situation here where, you know, it's the world's like center for manufacturing engineering, like, and mm-hmm, engineering excellence. They've got an extraordinary number of extraordinarily talented engineers and, sure, like modern factories that are, you know, I think perhaps still somewhat of a meme in general, but, you know, we're getting there, or they're getting there, of like dark factories where just, raw materials come in and like finished products come out. But, and I just wonder, like, you've obviously had a whole host of conversations on the topic and made a series of, been making forecasts, including, mm-hmm, in Sentinel on China. Can you give us a bit of a sense of just like where you see the, you know, across like economics and military, where and so on, where you see China going in the sort of the next 3 to 5 years?
Right. So to frame the discussion, the probabilities that I've seen across various forecasters and at this conference are very roughly in the like 10, 15 to 60% range that China will invade Taiwan by 2030.
Yeah, which is...
So it's not 0.5%. It's not 95%. It is... it's in that range. And surprising... And so I came in here with being in the lower range of that. And even then, part of my probability was that if China has the capability of actually invading Taiwan, it may not have to.
Sure.
So even then, I'm not saying that China is... So I'm talking about the specific operationalization of boots on the ground.
Right, right. Because one of the like very kind of threatening modes of war for Taiwan, I think, is just blockade.
Yeah.
You know, they shut down their nuclear plants. Mm-hmm. They're like almost entirely reliant on imports for like energy and, mm-hmm. and food and so on. Obviously, they export an awful lot of like manufactured goods. But as far as daily living is concerned, incredibly vulnerable to blockade. And, you know, with the changes that we've been seeing in the last, even this year, such as in the Red Sea and the mm-hmm. vulnerability of, up until very recently, almost kind of unquestionably supreme U.S. naval power. For people who aren't aware, there's a series of cases where an F-16 was shot down by Houthis.
I don't think it was shot down. I think it fell from the back
of
fire.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. Because the ship was under attack and they had to take
maneuvers. The ship is going, but yeah. Then... moving it so that the missile doesn't hit.
And this happened twice, right? And then that led to the carrier group essentially withdrawing from that particular theater.
It's a bit more complicated. I think US did a pretty large bombing campaign, and it spent hundreds of millions.
Right.
Hundreds of millions, maybe. Yeah, I did the math at some point, but like
sure.
a lot of money. Bombing Yemen,
right?
Employed a whole lot of its reserves of munitions. You did have this incident. Maybe I wouldn't characterize it as now the U.S. Navy is weak.
No. Yeah. But I think it seems to me almost certain that the era of like unquestioned naval superiority is over.
I mean, I think that'll be the case when somebody sinks on an aircraft carrier. But even then,
okay. But this is like the Houthis in Yemen we're talking about here. We're not like I just can't see that the U.S. would kind of have the same approach to, you know, parking a couple aircraft carriers near Taiwan and just like expecting that would be enough of a deterrent. Anymore, like mm-hmm. I kind of struggle to see it, given the capabilities of China are significantly greater than mm-hmm. that of the Houthis. And then we also saw this incident, in the recent conflict between India and Pakistan, where the Chinese jets shot down the Rafale, the French derived ones, which mm-hmm. you know do share quite a number of similarities with some of the U.S. equipment that is currently in service.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think you do want to go for the like big picture. I think some other selling factors are. I'd bring up some other factors. So I think China has been taking costly steps to increase its readiness. It has been building new technology to invade and to be able to land in different parts of Taiwan. And you see right. this invasion barges
mm-hmm.
has developing technology to cut internet cables more efficiently. It continues to integrate the military and civilian infrastructure. And overall, it's just building the capability.
Whether or not it uses it or whether it's just a kind of a stick to kind of threaten mm-hmm. with. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, the another shelling aspect of the Houthis, the Houthi American conflict, right. wasn't so much that an F-16
flames
fell over, as having more hotspots that distracted the U.S.
Yeah.
So if the U.S. is contributing to the Ukraine conflict.
Right.
And it has to support Israel against Iran. And, you know, maybe there's some third hotspot, maybe Venezuela invades Guyana, or maybe the...
Is this purely... Like, have you put some work into that particular... Is that more likely that I had heard...
I don't think Venezuela invading Guyana is particularly likely, but it's interesting.
But across the set of all of those possible things,
right.
It's all, like, it's actually reasonably likely that some kind of third hotspot of interest to America.
I'm tracking the possibility.
Okay.
Guyana has some oil.
Yeah,
in sections that
enormous Venezuela. Growth and, and U.S. companies and kind of deeply mm-hmm. involved in it
for sure.
Yeah,
and in a section that Venezuela either wants or disputes.
Right.
I don't think there's going to be there, but like it's another hotspot. And so if the U.S.'s attention is divided across different places, and you get maybe some instability in the U.S. Maybe that would be a good moment to make. Yeah, I'm not saying anything hugely revolutionary here.
Sure.
All of, you know, the Russian, the Iranian, the North Korean, and the Chinese economy are all getting more integrated. So maybe a high-level trend to keep in mind is whether there will be a bloc that gives some healthy competition to the U.S., or whether they will integrate themselves militarily and will there be a hot conflict there?
Right. Yeah. You mentioned Ukraine. I imagine you'll have seen the images of fields that look like they're covered in silk or something, of just all the fiber optic cables,
mm-hmm.
Just absolutely covering the ground almost as far as the eye can see. This one photo I've seen, which I assume is representative of like a lot of the front. But might not be. But let's just take a quick step back. You know, that's a conflict that started, you know, in 2022, almost in a sort of like almost vaguely World War II style, like in terms of military affairs. You know, we're talking mm-hmm. about artillery. Trenches came a little later, but you know, you're talking about like this Bewegungskrieg kind of approach of the Russians early on. We're just gonna, you know, absolutely rip into their, you know, come into Kyiv.
Trenches from that World War II, trenches from World War One,
right, and then, yeah, like that fails
because the U.S. and because
and some like heroics at the airport outside to like stop the landings, but in any mm-hmm. case, it devolves into like a quasi World War One style mm-hmm. kind of artillery and high Mars conflict for a period. And then maybe around like last year, you're talking about like this sort of like exponential growth in the usage of drones. And then we've seen this sort of like measure and countermeasure occurring where, you know, electronic warfare. So, you know, to block the use of first person drones wirelessly. So, you know, they fall out mm-hmm. of the sky. And then the response to that being utilizing fiber optic cables so that you're, you know, in a big spool. So that you basically, you're not wireless, you're just flying this thing and it's got a very thin little thread. And now, like, as I said, you're in this position where it's just like, that's the war. The nature of the war almost is like primarily a drone war with like, you know, both sides rapidly like ramping up production. You're talking about a complete revolution there. Do you see, so there's a few questions that come from this. Like, do you see that as being the kind of the end state of that conflict? Are there other kind? Is there another revolution in the nature of that war or war in general coming? And you know, like autonomy, for example, is something that's you know, being mentioned in mm-hmm. these circles. Or is there some other technologies that you think possibly likely to you know, change again the nature of the war? And then, of course, like there's also this quite dramatically recently. There was a sort of like the mother truck deep into behind Russian territory,
Russian
destroying a number of strategic bombers. It strikes me that, or it concerns me that, you know, if this war continues, you may end up with a degree of total war, like unprecedented in like human society, where it's just like every like, it doesn't matter how far behind the lines you are, you know, there's going to be potentially like drones flying around, like, you know, taking out bits of infrastructure and so on. Up until now, it's been like, with the exception of strategic bombing, like relatively contained in terms of like on the front. Whereas like, I don't know what it does to people psychologically, but anyway, I'm just curious, like, how do you see this conflict evolving?
I'm not sure. One aspect that's salient to me is the similarity with the Spanish Civil War, where you have
Where
you have different sides testing their own technology, which then diffuses after the conflict is over.
Right.
So I'm not going to be able to predict what the next turn is going to be.
Right.
But I can make the meta level prediction of, you are seeing rapid innovation in war, as you saw with radar, with submarines, with, you know, as you see in wars, because people have a real need to cut through the red tape, and Ukraine sees this as existential. Mm-hmm. So I can make the meta level prediction of, okay, what happens with the diffusion of these technologies? What lessons are different players taking from field?
So diffusion of technology. I mean, diffusion, like, in terms of like right now, most of that expertise is like highly concentrated
for the conflict, yeah, right?
China's producing a lot of drones, but they won't necessarily have like the knowledge of, you know, just that kind of in-depth understanding of how to use them strategically and so on. And
I mean, it's quite close to, but Russia will. Right.
So that's what you mean by like a diffusion of the production capabilities, like specific to like war drones, as opposed to like surveying, and then also the how to use them, like at the operational level, at the strategic level.
But then also, if the conflict ends, that production capability will remain.
Right.
And there will be a profit motive to sell it to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Ukraine to the West, China to either use it for its own. Something.
Most of the Russian ones produced in Iran?
In Iran, yeah.
Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah. I'm actually not sure what proportion is produced in Iran versus China. China is apparently selling to both sides, which is very amusing to me.
Yeah.
Something I'm also worried about in the background is what will happen with conflicts in Africa that are just going on constantly. Russia has used its Wagner group, which is now I think called somewhere else, to intervene in systematically in the region.
Yeah, particularly like north.
Yeah, Mali. But then separately, it also now has tried to prop up its presence in Libya.
Okay.
In part to have access to the Mediterranean after
potentially losing the Syrian
air base. Yeah. So it's interesting how these conflicts kind of globalize themselves, right?
Right.
France is also Macron is also saying that if North Korea keeps supporting Russia in Ukraine, maybe France will support South Korea, which is also like it makes total sense, but.
How would that look?
Technology transfer?
That doesn't. Yeah, it's interesting. I as I understand it, South Korean military technology is like broadly comparable with anything that the West is producing. I know Poland like purchased a whole host recently, perhaps somewhat controversially, instead of from Rheinmetall in Germany. Is that just like, is it rhetoric from back on? You're not sure. Okay. Yeah, I'm not quite following that, but I'd have to look into it. So I suppose, you know, we've talked about Taiwan. I mean, you're talking about 15% to 60% chance.
It's, in some sense, it's a wide range.
Sure.
You wouldn't see that spread in the prediction market.
Right.
But then it's also a longer term market, right?
Right.
There's some disagreement about how to synthesize the existing information, but at the same time, it is in some sense reasonably close together, right?
Right. So, but whatever the percentage is, like, very clear that it's, like, the likelihood is significant.
Yeah.
And that is, given your the operationalization you were talking about earlier, is only a proportion of the total risk of, because, you know, you're talking about boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to add, at the very least, the blockade to that, which would be an act of war. I've heard quite strong arguments that strategically that would seem to make a lot of sense.
With blockades, it's quite interesting because one thing we have seen in with Russia and China is that they're good at the salami slicing or the spoiling the frog strategy of not giving the other party a Pearl Harbor that it can easily coordinate.
So this is like the cutting of the cables that we're seeing.
Yeah. So we've seen cutting
increasing incursion into the airspace.
Yeah, incursion
into while the I was there was a missile which went over the top of the country, and there was a warning out to all, like, to everybody for your phones.
And
just it's all normalizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, normalizing it, but then also forcing Taiwan to be on higher alert more of the time, which
It's fatigue costly. For the sailors and so on. Yeah, I know.
And it's interesting because you could see a straight up blockade, but then you could see things that are ambiguously a blockade.
Right.
And then, you know, the US maybe does a freedom of navigation exercise and so the semi blockade there ends or doesn't end.
Right.
You can see inspections, or you can see minimally plausible deniable cutting of cables.
And this is like happening, I mean, not just in Taiwan, but also like particularly with the Philippines, right? Like in those various kind of, like, not far from the Filipino mainland, these islands, and it's like use of water cannons and all kinds of things rather than like ramming of Filipino Coast Guard ships and kind of this sort of...
Also cyber attacks. So the US is not going to declare war to China over a cyber attack. But at the same time,
So I suppose, you draw all this together, and it's going to be this significant risk there of like an increasing, like an escalation of what we're seeing. How should we like think about how this would like there's a lot of talk about essentially a domino type effect.
So I'm focused on the domino type effect because I'm focused on the large scale risks.
Right.
At each step, I want to the question that I'm asking is, how could this scale up into a global conflict? In the case of geopolitics, this looks like me looking at the way in which you could get in which conflicts could become global and like have a World War III. But you could also get things that are much more local.
Sure.
And indeed, you have the
like already like ongoing with borders disputes in the Himalayas with India and those kinds of things. And that just escalates a little bit, but it's always this kind of cold war. Like it doesn't never kind of...
Yeah.
Some lines aren't crossed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the arguments is that like any significant change with Taiwan is going to leave Japan and South Korea, Philippines, obviously Vietnam, in like a really precarious position. There are islands claimed by each of those nations that China also claims, and you know, were Taiwan to kind of, I suppose, like the peaceful reintegration scenario, where like maybe the population, like, in some respects, like maybe it's just compelled to capitulate peacefully. Those sorts of scenarios don't occur, but to the extent like that, it's some kind of like, you know, more obviously coercive quasi war scenario. You'd be thinking that those nations that I mentioned and India would be like significantly raising their own like readiness and kind of almost belligerence, attempting to kind of recruit like hard line like lines in the sand from the US about if such and such occurs, you know, you'd see a sort of...
Yeah, you could see that the scenario. You could also think about the scenario where these countries want to be more integrated with China as its manufacturing capability rises.
Right.
And you know, in some sense, become more dependent. The
right.
US it tries to set up red lines but fails.
Sure.
Yeah,
it's quite... You know, it's quite a bit of this like in Syria, for example. And mm-hmm. Interesting. Because coming back, we've talked a lot about like the military situation. We talked about this sort of like maybe some misconceptions about the nature of Chinese manufacturing and so on. But I think like in general, that there's a lot of kind of clinging to particular ideas around like local government debt and declining, like an aging population and like the housing kind of bubble that's mm-hmm. popped recently and so on. Like China is very obviously not some kind of like titan bestriding the world. On the one hand, it's got its problems, it's a range of internal tensions. There's some extent to which like the President Xi is kind of a single point of failure that creates mm-hmm. these kind of like really, really dumb things happen at times because of the nature of the bureaucracy, like with the Shanghai like attempts to be zero COVID yes. long after that ship had long since sailed, but people are just like bolted into their apartments and kind of like but the flip side of that is because you I think those sorts of things can often be quite widely disseminated on social media and so on because they're quite dramatic. The flip side of it is like that actually economically China's in a very healthy position and is producing all kinds of value mm-hmm. like you're sort of saying that peer nations surrounding nations and Australia, New Zealand obviously are like keen to be a part of and continue to have access to Chinese markets and so on and if the depending on how these trade like the current trade situation develops with US tariffs mm-hmm. a lot of that could really end up pushing those much closer economic ties to China right.
Let me give you some pushback on I think you have in mind the picture of a listener that thinks that China's gonna fall tomorrow because of their
or like
paper tiger, right?
Sure. But communist regimes are like mm-hmm. very strong on paper and maybe not yeah. nearly so much in practice.
I have some sympathy for that. Like,
sure.
It's hard to see regimes falling before they do. So maybe the forecasting perspective would be, okay, fine. So you give like a 1-10% chance of it falling over the next however minute period and then the communist party just falls. Fine. Like that doesn't seem like... maybe I'd like disagree with that, but right. I don't think it's crazy. Yeah. So if somebody disagrees with you on this frontally, the forecasting perspective would say yes. Like assign a 10% chance to China falling in the next 5 years, in the next decade.
Right.
Maybe because the dynamics we're not seeing, because right. we just don't have the knowledge. Maybe because the transition after Xi is botched.
Right.
Maybe because
there's an interesting fact there that mm-hmm. I learned recently was that the two presidents before Xi were handpicked by Deng Xiaoping. So yeah. it was this kind of like great man in history type yeah. character, almost a second revolution within the revolution. And so there hasn't really been any succession up before Xi, and the system is not like well catered to do so. It wasn't particularly well catered to do so before mm-hmm. Xi, and Xi has like dramatically reduced the capability of
it has sent a lot of power.
So maybe
you give a 10% chance to
the Communist Party kind of collapsing.
It could also just change its name, right?
Right.
And sort of formalize that its system is
or like a sort of a Stalin to Khrushchev type succession.
You could have that or like a Khrushchev to who was the president before Yeltsin?
There was a few
a few of the old ones, right? You could get that kind of thing. Like you could get a few old
guys that are kind of like Pope kind of scenario where like everybody elects like they end up because they like select the guy that's seen as being like the least likely to be elected and he's really old anyway and so we'll just like bide our time and then we'll happens like a series of occasions.
I haven't thought a whole lot, but I would have some sympathy to something in the 1-10% range. But then I would also have some sympathy to something in the 10-60% range of China invading
sure
and you know a big chunk of that, in a big chunk of that, it pulls it off. And then another maybe like 5% in which China just like blows everything out of the water.
Right, right. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I suppose to my mind, leaving aside succession problems or some kind of like internal black swan type event that means that the support for the party undergoes some sort of like preference cascade where suddenly everybody's like, ah, actually, the hell with them. It seems the country, as like leaving aside the political situation, the country like economically, like socially, that even demographically is very unlikely to be undergoing some sort of like sudden USSR type collapse anytime soon. Like, you know, mm-hmm. there's like empty shelves and, you know, like massive kind of, you know, like these sorts of scenarios perhaps are more popular than they should be. Would that be fair? You don't know about
it. I'm not sure. yeah, I think to some extent you want to attack somebody else's big picture.
All right.
I think,
right.
But you propose a big picture
of my own.
Of your own that I don't find convincing either.
Yeah.
I'm sympathetic to it, but I would inject more uncertainty.
Sure. Well, like I'm just trying to paint for listeners like an alternative viewpoint. I'm not. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Look, I mean, that was there anything else on China that you know, you've been thinking about that you think, or more generally in that kind of that geopolitical space that you think we haven't talked about?
I'm curious about New Zealand, right? So you're much more integrated in with the institutions there.
It helps that we're so small.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a Singapore, but if it were spread out across the entire U.S. Eastern Seaboard.
Mm-hmm.
So what can I tell you?
You were telling me that it has already some infrastructure to deal with earthquakes, natural disasters.
Right.
How do you think how does that look like for more out there possibilities?
So New Zealand is tremendously prone to civil defense disasters.
Mm-hmm.
We live on the Ring of Fire. Earthquakes happen, you know, like tremendously geologically active. There are volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the midst of an enormous ocean, and cyclones are not uncommon. But more than cyclones, I think, like we don't tend to get the sort of like a category 5 issues in New Zealand, but more like of like really high winds and so on, but rather just like enormous dumps of rain that cause like widespread flooding. So these are all like reasonably common, which gives us in a funny sort of way quite an advantage in that civil defense disasters in general are not, almost never a black swan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like you know, it's only been a few years, perhaps maybe 10, since the last time that, you know, the local or the regional kind of group has had to be spun up, and mm-hmm. and we've had to rediscover like how the systems work and so on.
We had that in Spain with the flooding in Valencia, where we hadn't had that, so the systems were just rusting.
It does. So I think we're kind of lucky in a sense that this is not the case in New Zealand, that mm-hmm. You don't tend to have, I mean, I think the real difficulties with institutions often are generational in nature, mm-hmm. where you can get, as long as people within an institution learn from people that had been there, it's, you know, it's not ideal, mm-hmm. But you know, you're always going to get some degree of retirements and people kind of moving on and so on. And whereas it's very difficult for the subsequent generation to learn from the people that never been through it themselves either. And so you get like a general atrophy of capabilities. And I think that the response to COVID, for example, is quite an interesting one. We were one of two nations, along with Taiwan, that became COVID-free. And I was initially like, this surprised me quite a lot, to be honest. It had been banging the drum. I've been paying attention to forecasters in February 2020, and attempting. I was much more junior at that stage, but attempting to sort of raise awareness. We need to deal with this, and I was literally laughed at. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, COVID! Like, I've got more important things to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like quite skeptical about our capacity to respond as we would. And, you know, like markets are crashing internationally. Italy was under like this enormous lockdown. And we're sort of like merrily going about our day as news comes out that like there's been some super spreader event at some wedding and people look like, and meanwhile, literally like the civil defense, like I suspect national people in the national centers were beginning to sort of by that point, like, we should be thinking about this, but certainly at the regional and local level, not like they weren't activated. Nobody was preparing. Like I said, I was skeptical, but once the decision was made, actually, we were able to like spin up within a few days. Yeah, there were problems. The initial decision by the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, to the stay-at-home order was actually later ruled to be illegal. But in general, you know, like the nation kind of came together. Not only the sort of institutional capability, but like the nation as a whole is sort of threw it often enough that we're like, okay, what are we doing now? Mm-hmm. Okay, this is happening. You know, many people would have had stories prior to them of, you know, an evacuation due to some event, like a storm event or something, or had friends or family that had been through it. So the idea of it all was pretty straightforward for us, even though the actual idea of locking down in a pandemic and what does that kind of mean operationally in terms of mm-hmm. food and all was completely unprecedented. We were able to do it well enough that COVID, that initial strain, disappeared, and we were kind of having big New Year's parties while the rest of the world stayed inside, which, you know, a certain degree of civic pride there, albeit like many people in our position often are, there was a degree of like overconfidence there that, right. You know, these new strains come out, they're significantly more contagious, popular will to like, okay, we're just going to do this forever begins to erode. There was a series of lockdowns that were reimposed, particularly in Auckland, and the government, which was re-elected with a sweeping majority in 2020, popularity like began to to tank quite quickly.
So here's my reaction to this, which is, seems like you do have experience with disasters on the 5-10 year cadence.
Sure.
But then that seems like a good foundation to then consider also worrying about scenarios that are like a bit less likely than that, because you have the existing infrastructure. So, and then, you know, there is a long road down unlikely or more speculative stuff. You could look at solar flares, and so you have the Carrington event, this mm-hmm. very big solar mm-hmm. flare that...
As I understood it, they were like, the aurora was like visible in New York during the day.
Yeah.
Or something at
fried telegraph cables.
Yeah.
I think, an event like that probably wouldn't destroy electric grids, to disrupt them, but probably would not destroy it. But it's not clear to me. And, you know, having backup transformers just seems robustly good. Though at the same time, you know, they are expensive and hard to get. But if you prepare for that in advance, that's something you can do.
That I've talked to in New Zealand around this particular scenario actually suggest that we're really well prepared for it. Yeah. When I learned, it seems so esoteric, our solar flares.
I'll follow up.
Yeah,
In particular, I am uncertain about this.
Right.
And in particular, are you prepared for the largest event that has happened so far, or are you prepared by an event that's like a bit larger? And if so, how much is that range?
Yeah,
so that's an interesting question.
Sure.
You have COVID, but then, you know, from COVID to a Black Death, there is still some way. You can, or, you know,
Spanish flu.
The Spanish flu was interesting because in part was selected for virality because, let me see if I get this right. Oh, yeah. It was selected for virulence and didn't care that much about the death rate because it was in military hospitals. Because if you kill people...
Before they can pass it on.
No. If you kill people in a dense military hospital in a way that allows you to spread the disease more, and the origins are quite packed together,
right?
That that might select for both reality and deathliness. Mm-hmm. Whereas normally, if you have a stronger disease, maybe you don't go out to a party, and so it selects for mildness.
I see. But specifically military hospitals, where a lot of these people are like on the edge of death anyway. Yeah. And it's also like viewed by authorities like a comorbidity rather than, to the extent that's noticed at all, rather than, oh gosh, a whole heap of people are getting really sick and dying. Yeah. We should take action.
Yeah. But this is just not natural selection sped up through World War II. But you could imagine versions of this that are out there. You could imagine AI creating a more Black Death kind of pathogen,
or enabling
something
particularly mustache twirling villain to do so.
And you can think of like, you know, complete Black Swans. How do you prepare for a complete Black Swans?
Sure.
It's a tricky question. I was talking with a fiction writer here at this conference who was saying, okay, have a scenario that is like really out there and extremely low probability, but that you're sure that your audience hasn't thought about. He was proposing run a war game on invasion from another dimension.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
The probability of that physically is negligible, but it's good. It's good as a scenario that you haven't thought of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Food for thought. Like, I'm not worried about invasion from another dimension.
Right.
But I do like the.
But like as a way of considering preparedness, you might consider something absolutely kind of absurd, and just as a way of working through the idea of something equally absurd to us now or outlandish, but that actually happens.
How do you prepare for the invention of nukes? You know, maybe you prepare
That's really interesting. Well, look, I think we're coming towards the end now, but mm-hmm. Was there anything else you kind of like last burning kind of thoughts on forecasting, on risk, you wanted to cover?
I think the asking what I make is, if you have some really good infrastructure for dealing with natural disasters, consider expanding it to scenarios that seem a bit more outlandish or speculative, but that it might still be good to prepare for.
Wonderful.
Great.
All right. Nuno Simperi, thanks very much.
I will give you a fist bump. Cheers.
Cheers.